I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
This is Spoke, the all-new and exclusive podcast series with me, Chidera, a.k.a. The Slum Flower.
And me, Sully Breaks, poet, writer, spoken word, artist, etc., etc.
Where we discuss issues at the heart of youth culture and how music and literature are shaping the conversation. With knife crime in the UK at an all-time high, music is often singled out among the complex social factors that add up to crime in inner cities. Genres such as grime and heavy metal have taken the blame in the past, and more recently, many drill artists have come under fire, with their videos being pulled from mainstream sites and even being forced onto Pornhub.
In the same way film and literature come under heavy scrutiny for their portrayals of sex and violence, books such as Clockwork Orange and American Psycho have been criticised in the past for their graphic scenes, with the argument that they incentivise the public to commit similar crimes.
But does art reflect your environment or shape it? Like violent films or video games, can people distinguish fact from fantasy, or do they let it influence their behaviour? And what are young people doing to challenge these misconceptions?
In this episode, we discuss sex, violence, and the obscene in art.
Cool.
What's good, Judy?
There's a lot happening.
There's a lot happening.
I feel like we're going to have quite different perspectives, because obviously I'm a woman.
How is that obviously? After all the discussions we've been having, how is it going to be obvious that your opinion is going to differ because you're a woman?
Well, the thing is, when you're a woman and you are in media, sometimes, or in fact, most of the time, you are some sort of product. And so when it comes to things like sex and violence, a lot of the time there are, you know, lazy plot scenes where a woman is being assaulted, for example, and that isn't really cool. But also it's about essentially recognising that art in itself, as much as it is about having a conversation and being able to express and reflect the times, it can sometimes still perpetuate misogyny in a way. Well, that's my experience anyway as a woman.
I can totally understand that. But in that same way, we're talking about other people and their responsibility, don't you inherently as well feel that you have an assumed responsibility? Because even as an ambassador or as an activist, in a way, you're constantly, your book is out, you're constantly creating art yourself. Mm-hmm. And within that art, is there not some kind of identity that you want to champion, or some kind of message that you feel like may get misconstrued or manipulated if you don't convey it properly?
Yeah, I'm really protective and quite calculated and careful, because I recognise that my role is one that's quite important. To some people, I'm a pillar of strength, and I want to make sure that I am not just living authentically, but also allowing people to see that even their faves make mistakes. Yeah. And the most important thing is how your fave recovers from that mistake. But most importantly, what they do to acknowledge it and change the way that they act moving forward.
I can relate to that. I think that's very important. And with that, we'd want to introduce our two amazing guests that we have here, two extremely talented young gentlemen. Now, what's important, I want you guys to introduce yourself, but we have a policy here. We don't have time for humbleness. Do you understand
what
I'm saying? We don't have time for that.
Big yourself up.
So tell us exactly who you are, what you do, and why they're going to remember you when you die. Do you understand what I'm saying? Don't come and give us no pressure.
Go in deep, Lord.
Cool, man. So do you want to...
No, you go first. You go first.
Oh, right. Go on,
Maverick.
That was quite a little deep intro there now. I'm feeling the pressure already. My name's Maverick Sabre. I'm a singer-songwriter. I'm 28. And I'm just starting to release music for my third album. I've been touring the world releasing music for the last 10 years. Jeez. 11 years of my life. And that is about it. Thank you.
This man's got a catalogue. Don't let him humble you, though. This guy's got a catalogue. This guy's got a legacy.
There so sick. Like, I was just fangirling. Like,
before. Love how you said fangirling.
No, because I was literally fangirling him before we went live. But yeah, I'm Femi Oyeniran. I'm an actor. I'm a filmmaker. I started out when I was 17 in a film called Kidulthood. I did all the hoods after that, apart from Brotherhood. And I've since gone on to make film and TV. I produced a TV series called Venus vs. Mars for Sky Living, and I did Droppers for ITV2. I have also written, produced, acted, been the creative force alongside with my writing partner, Nikki, on a film called It's a Lot. And we made The Intent, which we made independently and distributed independently, and is now on Netflix.
Jeez.
And now we are on the sort of like coming to the end of the promo run of the sequel, The Intent 2. The prequel. Even I need to get used to the fact
because it comes
that
after the first movie.
Yeah. So the prequel, The Intent 2, which is been well received and is violent.
Just get that out of the way, man.
Nice little intro there. Yeah. Right?
Let's talk about that, because we're all artists here. We're all creating some capacity. So the first real question really is, before we address how we personally create our art and what we think, have you guys ever specifically been influenced by art? Because I'm talking when I was young and I go to school, like, you know what I mean? I was a hip hop fan. Mm-hmm. And I knew that, say if there was a day where I knew that I was like, I might get into altercation with someone, like I might need to fight someone, I'd listen to Mobb Deep, you know what I mean? And I'm listening to that in my ears, like I'm going
what,
all out.
You
know what I mean? Big guns, sharp knives, revolvers, jam at the wrong times, you know what I mean? So let's talk about art first as a subject, like you guys in general. Before we talk about what we create, have you ever been, remember a time in your life when art really influenced you and who you was as a person?
Yeah, I think for me, I was a big hip-hop fan growing up, from like a lot of UK and Irish hip-hop and a lot of American stuff. And I think a lot of the stuff for me and the friends around me, what we were influenced off, especially on the US stuff, was like early, mid-90s.
Yeah.
And I did feel at the time, early, mid-90s had a lot of extremes, but had a lot of balance in hip-hop. Mm. You know what I mean? You could get your educational, revolutionary information from a Public Enemy listening, or you can listen to A Tribe Called Quest or Mos Def to get a feel. Or you could get your, you know, more gangster elements, or your more smooth stuff from an LL Cool J, or your history lesson sometimes from a Tupac Shakur. I was a big Tupac Shakur
100,
fan.
Yeah.
So, like, the what you're saying there, like the idea of, you know, being young and being influenced by art, for me it was influenced on various different levels. It was the same. You go in to get a scrap, you know you're going to get into scrap this morning.
That DMX,
I'm going to bang a bit of DMX and run down the road. You know what I mean? But at the same time, when I'm walking home and I need something, you know, to comfort me or whatever's going on in my head, I'd listen to like the sagas of Kalashnikov or Skinny Man Counts
to the
State
of Mind. Let's talk about that.
You know
real
so
talk.
It was like a balance, which I think maybe as we grow up, maybe we look down on a generation and feel like, did they have the same balance that maybe we had? And maybe they do, and maybe we're just judging them too heavy.
To it, 100.
You know, so. I completely agree. I mean, I remember, you know, initially, like, I suppose my cultural references for the West begins with, like, late 90s, because I moved to England in 97. Mm-hmm. Before that, like, you know, my consumption of culture and art was quite limited.
I'd say
born in Nigeria, and I lived in Nigeria for 10 years. And like, you know, like I watched Disney films, I listened to Nigerian records, and like I listened to King Sunny Ade. And then what you listen to from the West back then, now it's changed because of the internet, but back then what you listened to, the Western stuff you listened to, were the super commercial things. So like I knew about Michael Jackson.
Yeah.
I knew about, like, you know, the stuff that really cut through. So like, as like, you know, my big Western references like really began in 97. So if it's not Disney or pop, I can't even talk to you about anything really, unless you want to talk about Nigerian music or Nigerian culture.
Yeah.
And so So for me, like, you know, what I remember moving to England and I late 90s rap was really gangster rap, really. That was what was dominating the scene. And so, but I wasn't really immediately into rap. I was like, I was into everything. I liked Robbie Williams when I was young. Like, when I first come to England, I thought Robbie Williams was so sick. I thought Robbie Williams was so amazing. Like, he just had the tunes, man.
He did,
like,
he had the bangers. You can't dispute that. He had proper bangers.
I was into all of this stuff. Then you go to school, like you go to like you, and but my brethren were all into like Drew Hill and stuff like that. And then you go to school and the minute you go to secondary school, like everyone's being hard now. And also on top of it, my cousin, my older cousin, who now like works at like the biggest investment bank in the world, I don't even need to say the name, like, and has done for like the past 10 or 15 years. He was into rap heavy. And so he showed me about downloading songs. So I used to illegally download music. Like,
LimeWire.
No one's got ever. No, I was before LimeWire. I was Napster.
Okay. Take it back.
I was Napster because my cousin was doing microelectronic engineering, which is computers. Which is basically computers and like building apps. That's what you'd call it. But he was doing that back in, like, the late 90s, early noughties. So, like, he got me into, like, rap. And now he doesn't even listen to rap. He listens to gospel all the time. So I just think it's an age thing, you know? Yeah. Like, a lot of it is down to an age thing. Because, like, you know, when you're talking about Tribe Called Quest and all of that stuff, I didn't get into it till late. Mm-hmm. I banged Tribe Called Quest, like, in the past sort of, like, 7 years. Because, like, I remember when my older son was born, and I was he's seven now, and I remember like that was the point I really fully got into Tribe. Like, I wasn't really into them. I like DMX, I like Snoop Dogg, I like all the Rude Boys, and I was into Grime, I was into So Solid, I was into like, because I grew up on an estate and I wanted to be a Rude Boy.
Yeah, you wanted to relate.
And you have to be a Rude Boy to survive. Like, 100. I like all the bad boys.
You had to join Bad Gang.
Yeah, no, I'll be honest. I didn't join Bad Gang, but...
But you had to understand.
You had to be hard. You had to be a bad man because you're walking from Safeway with your mum's money and you don't look like a Rude Boy. Get robbed. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, it's like back in the day, people used to get robbed for their mobile phone. I saw a kid get robbed for his box meal from Chicken Shop at the bus stop. When I was coming home from school. So, like, that was the era that I was growing up in. And, like, and because of that, that influenced my mentality and influenced what I was into. And as you get older, you open up your mind a little bit. And education opens up your mind, going to uni and stuff like that. And, like, different experiences. Like, seeing the world beyond your estate and beyond your limited group of friends opens up your mind to the type of music you listen to. Mm-hmm. But if I tell you the truth, like, even though I was going to church every Sunday with my mum, I was banging out DMX nonstop.
Damien, boy,
You know.
Conflicted.
DMX has got a tune, where he talks about, like, he could be, like, I can't even remember what it's called, but he's, like, talking about how he can move to you. He's like, I could be the delivery boy hiding outside your house.
Oh, he's
in
different scenarios.
Yeah, he's got all these different scenarios. He's talking about how he can move to you. Yeah. He's like, here we go again. Like, you know, like, I was like, this is so hard. Yeah. And I don't know, like, now, I've never been really, I had loads of fights in school, maybe that's why. But, like, I've grown up, I've never really been a violent person, like, in real life. But, like, I was really attracted to that as a young man growing up.
Because I think it emulated the reality that you was familiar with all that time that we were trying to, like, assimilate towards. You know what I'm saying? Let's talk about you guys' items and what you have for us today, Maverick.
For me, it was the song, and especially because I've just been reading a lot about the history of N.W.A. more. I was always an N.W.A. fan, but...
You seen Straight Outta Compton?
I have seen Straight Outta Compton, yeah. And it was the song Fuck the Police and the reaction towards that, which I felt was quite like, an interesting point at the time, even down to, I think it was like 1989 when they went to perform it in Detroit.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And they end up pulling the speakers out of the system. 18 people in the crowd ended up getting arrested because, had a reaction to that.
Yeah.
And then NWA themselves ended up getting arrested later that night at the hotel that they were staying in. And I thought that brings up quite an interesting, because I think, there's a big topic of discussion now at the moment is like freedom of speech.
Yeah.
And, where do we cross the line of inciting hatred or inciting violence? Mm. But then who is drawing that line?
That's a good point.
Who's drawing that line? It's like, you know, what they were speaking about was their reality in that sense, you know? So who suddenly draws the line and says, well, this is actually inciting violence, but what about the violence that's been incited on them to have that opinion in the first place?
That's talk, preach, talk now.
And I think just now is a very, I think there's a very poignant time where we need to be very careful of who we are allowing to draw the censorship line, you know?
Mm. It's true, because the person who gets to draw the line is the person who holds the power. It's like how, did you know that there are certain laws in place that allow you to protest within a certain set of parameters? So it's like, if you want to protest outside of a shop, a certain amount of meters you can stand near the shop to protest.
Yeah, right,
so it's like,
right.
It's almost like ironic how the person who you're protesting against is telling you, yeah, you're allowed to be angry, just like not too much. It's so weird how it works.
I've always found that interesting as well. Like when they'll be like, okay, this is a planned, scheduled protest. You know what I mean? This is the one we've approved of.
Like, yeah, is that protest
that it's approved?
It's like they have this thing. I'm not sure how recently they kind of put this into place, if they still do it. But I was seeing something the other day about during the Gulf War.
Yeah.
So whatever years that was like the end of the 70s to the mid 80s.
History guy.
That on radio, I think on the BBC, there was a list of like 60 songs that they could not play. And it was everything from John Legend, Imagine, to anything with arms or war in the title.
Wow.
And it was like, you think, all right, so you're already censoring people from even thinking
about
it.
Yeah.
I think that's really important. And that's where, for me, in my work, I'm sort of like, no, you can't tell me what to do. I can make what I like. Like, because like then ultimately, the minute you start restricting what people can't and can't make, or what people can't and can't talk about, like literally, like, you know, I'm like, well, the only reason I was able to relate to DMX and all of those people, because I thought in my small head, and the elders were the people that I grew up around, some of the older guys on the estates, they were up to no good. They were up to all of these things. So in a way, if someone made a song about that reality, I straight away, I'm like, I know that. I'm familiar with that. And is that art to be censored? So then we start arguing about actually whose story deserves to be told.
Yeah.
So, like, if people exist in a sort of working class environment, which is more precarious and is more likely to lead to violence, is their story not allowed to be told just because of that?
Or does it have to be filtered?
Does it always, is it only middle class people that are allowed to tell those stories? Or is it like, and all of these things, it makes me uncomfortable when people start questioning me and my work, because it's like, actually, why do you get to decide? Why do you have the power?
Yeah, right.
I'm curious for me, like, because obviously you're directing and telling these stories that threaten that power. But the interesting thing, which I found in my own career as well, is that you reach a point where the only people you can work with, or the only people that you can actually communicate with to get your work on that platform are the people who have the power that you're having to actually resist. And so the question is, like, how do you manage to maintain the true root of the story you're trying to tell without someone being like, well, you can't really say that, or someone feeling, you know, someone like meeting your story or your truth with friction? And like, are there times where you have to sort of creatively compromise in order to get your true root across? Do you get what I'm trying to say?
I feel like loads of people do. I just don't at the moment. I'm very fortunate because I'll tell you the truth, like with The Intent 2, we're very fortunate because we made The Intent 1. No one wanted to put it out, so we put it out ourselves and made loads of money from doing that. And because it was commercially successful, and because we sold it to Netflix for the world, because of all of that, when we came around to doing The Intent 2, no one could tell me what to put in a script. They couldn't, and they tried.
Really?
No, because they've tried. I mean, like, we got a long email from, like, we did cut scenes out.
Yeah.
But,
really?
But because we had to. There was a scene that we cut out. There's actually a scene. Because
what
I was
that film
I
in?
Would no, it's not in the film. I was uncomfortable with it.
Wow. Well, I mean, what,
okay,
what,
you'd have
give
to say
me
what the scene was.
I can tell you what it was.
Okay,
so there's if you've seen The Intent, there's a scene where there's two characters, Daniel and Leon, played by Krypton Conan. Intent 2, not the first Intent.
Yeah.
And they go into the main character's house. And
they attack his
pregnant girlfriend, but they don't know she's pregnant. She's not heavily pregnant. And And there's a scene, actually, that scene builds up to a crescendo, and there's a point where one of them's kicking in the brother's head.
Yeah.
But we've used sound to create that illusion. It's not really
because it's down, it's facing, the camera's facing
so
up.
So the camera's facing the guy kicking. And so it's kind of quite Tarantino, actually, the way we've done it, but whatever. Mm. And then there's a bit where one of them hits her in the stomach.
Oh.
And she falls onto the bed.
Yeah.
But then, actually, I felt it was a bit over the top because I couldn't watch it.
Yeah.
And so there came. So if I can't watch it,
how much was everyone
else? If I can't watch it, why couldn't anyone else watch it? And that was the bit I was saying to everyone: like, there's violence in this film, and there's guys going into places and sticking up people and, like, you know, shooting guns and stuff. But in my head, that is not even really violent because it's almost like it's weird because they're like they're just shooting these people, they're doing hits or whatever. But then there's this character that I've grown with and I know in the film, and I kind of like I've developed a bond with this character, and they're you know committing an act of violence on her person, like, you know, they're actually causing her to, like, were suggesting that they're causing her to lose this child in this way, and I just couldn't go with it. And they like one of the dish, they were all saying it's too violent, it's too. I'm like, yeah, it's an action film.
It is
gonna have guns in it. It's gonna have James Bond. If James Bond does it with no guns, that won't be James Bond.
Yeah, 100%.
If there's a James Bond where Bond does not use a gun, that's not Bond.
And that's generations of violence. Exactly. That's been going on
and
for
so
years.
Or a woman love interest sidekick.
Yeah, but I'm making an action film, so therefore there's going to be guns. Otherwise, I can't call it an action film. It's a drama with people talking. Like, you know, one of those ones. Yeah. But, like, you know, when we shot that scene, like, I didn't really think nothing of it because, again, it's done safely. We've got a stunts coordinator. And then you're cutting it and you're watching all the different edits. And then we got a note about it, and then, like, everyone was saying, like, you know, PR companies don't want to work on it because, like, it's too violent. And in my head, I'm like, the film's not violent. What are you talking about? It's not even... It's just an action film. All action films have, like, guns in it.
Terminator.
And then I was, like, watching it, and I was like, you know what? Maybe we should take out that scene.
Oh, I see.
I guess there's a sense of responsibility that came out.
Yeah, and that was... But there's loads of things, other situations where people were like, where's your line? Because you should have cut out a bunch of other scenes then if you're cutting that out. But actually, I'd always felt uncomfortable watching that scene throughout the edit process.
Mm.
And then that's your line then.
Yeah, that was like, you know
what,
I can't even be part of that.
That's interesting. I want to get onto your item, but just while we're on this subject of violence and interpretation of violence, do you feel like depending on the community he's coming from, there's going to be inherently more kind of skepticism towards, like, say if I say Maverick, for instance, we're going to get onto your item, Femi, but say if I say Maverick, because you make music that is kind of inherently influenced by Caribbean culture, do you feel like because you make that sort of music, inherently people make assumptions about the music and what its impact is when you perform it or when you make the music, because your music comes from a community that already stigmatized and people already see it a certain way, do you feel like inherently people are going to say no, it's aggressive music or it's sexualized music
and immediately attach that from,
because that's where all that censorship comes from?
I think naturally it does. I think naturally certain people only have one specific story about a culture or an art, and I think they carry that through their judgment any time that they hear about that being brought up. So, yeah, I would think that some people do.
Yeah, because I think it's interesting. I wouldn't necessarily say your music, but I was saying the sound of it. You get what I'm saying? So I didn't want to say music, because your music's your experience, but the sound and the influence,
Well, it's like I grew up in a small town in Ireland. I was always back and forth to London, but, you know, Irish hip-hop was quite a very small scene at the time. And only until quite recently... You know, are there more young rappers coming from more small towns? It's becoming that bit of an easier thing, you know. But you would get the common phrases of like, oh, what, you're just going to rap about, you know, having sex with women or shooting guns. You're not a gangster. What can you be a rapper for? Like, that perception immediately is the foundation of the stereotype of the culture as it is already. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But you would hope that over time, as that changes and more people start to do it, that like one story of that breaks down and people actually start to see...
Diversify their opinion
A diverse opinion of it all.
Let's get into your item, Femz. Femi, sorry. What did you bring for us today? Where did I go into Femz?
I don't know. That could be Femz.
I know, I feel like that's only in the WhatsApp group, though. It's the professional.
But you guys got a WhatsApp group?
Nah, just me trying to get his attention.
Us chatting. But yeah, I brought this book called Open Mic by Ewan Spencer. How do you say that name? Ewan.
Yeah,
so Open Mic Volume 2. And I remember I was reading it. Well, I'm writing a script about Iron Upper at the moment. And like, so I'm just like watching everything.
Based in Iron Upper or about Iron Upper?
No, about, you know, some kids going on holiday to Iron Upper back in 2003. Oh, yeah. And so I was reading it, and then this book, and it's got a chapter with Dizzy Rascal. And Dizzy's talking about the fact that he got to a point in his career where he didn't want to go to all those raves anymore, where he just felt like, you know, he felt like he couldn't be in those places anymore because there was always violence attached to it. And there was always, to go to a rave back in the day when we're younger,
real,
it's like you knew something might pop off.
Mm-hmm. I've never been to a grime rave in my life because as a child, like you're saying, I've never been. It wasn't safe. Like, the idea of people going to grime raves now baffles me because I was like, right, you're trying to get stabbed. Like, do you understand? Because this was me going from my house in Wood Green to Stratford Rex and I knew that I was going to be on top. So yeah. I'd only go there for like Ghana Independence Day. But you know what I'm saying? But I wasn't trying to go there to sit in, you know what I'm saying? So I can totally relate to what you're saying.
Yeah, and so he spoke about the fact that he just had to move on. Like, you know, he had to move on from like, he couldn't be around that scene anymore. And so he decided to turn his back on the scene at a time where the scene was still quite live. Mm-hmm. You know, like the scene was still
happening.
Yeah,
them times was mad,
the raves were still happening. But he just had his first, like, you know, his first album come out.
Yeah.
And he just had to basically turn his back on that because in order to get to the next level in his career, he had to turn his back on that whole scene and the violence that was associated with it, which, true or not. And so, like, you know, it got me thinking, like, you know, about... I think about drill in the same way as I think about grime. But apart from drill, is a bit extreme.
It's predicated on the idea of the rap.
A bit weird.
Maybe like, because we're old, isn't
because
it?
Rap has never done that. Rap has never done, I stabbed someone yesterday, I'm going to rap about it today and make fun of their friends.
Yeah.
And I'm going to keep the score.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Rappers always been like, oh, rappers talking about things that may be real.
Maybe about resistance.
Storytelling. Like,
yeah.
But like, no, but these kids are really talking about 2-0 to us on a tune.
Yeah.
That was extreme to me. And so for me, like, you know, as much as I'm like, you know, you shouldn't demonize them, I think when it gets to that level, it's just like, where does the line stop? Do you know what I mean? Because then it becomes public safety. It's a policy issue. It's a politicians, police, the state then gets involved because you're talking about killing people.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And in real life, because they were in the papers yesterday and you're rapping. And so that, for me, made me uncomfortable. But like, at the same time, I feel like we need to be careful with that. Again, because these kids are creating something new, right? Mm. And it's like something fresh. Apart from that level of it that I don't understand, like, there are drill rappers that don't do that.
Mm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But they're being tarnished with the same brush. There are, like, you know, just like when grime started, I remember being into grime and grime. No one liked it.
Yeah,
everyone
them
else,
times, innit?
No one liked it. Everyone now
none
goes
of the
on
girls
like,
liked
Grime's
it, bruv.
A
yeah,
chief,
yeah, yeah.
Grime's this.
And
this.
Grime was getting slated as much.
Yeah.
As well,
yeah.
You know
Grime
I mean?
Was in the papers. Probably the first time Wiley made the papers was because, like, a Grime rave got locked off. Like, it was getting destroyed. But everyone pretends like that never happened.
Trust me. You couldn't listen to Grime with a girl where she'd just be like, I don't like that. You know what I'm saying? It's like
why
I
you
remember
listen
them
to this?
Times.
And
yeah.
all the girls would stand to the side at the raves when they started playing Grime. There was all of that, basically, that for me, I just feel like who, like you said, like we've touched on it, who decides?
Censorship.
Censorship.
Yeah.
Mm. Apart from it saying explicit on the CD,
yeah,
and my film saying it's a 15, so under 15 shouldn't watch it.
Yeah.
Who then draws the line? Because if the BBFC have watched my film and classified it as a 15, that means anyone above the age of 15 should think it's okay.
Yeah.
And so when people are saying, oh, yeah, your film's violent, it's kind of irrelevant because the BBFC would ban it if it was too violent.
Mm.
So then do the BBFC and the music industry, do they have a power to make moral decisions?
And also, does the responsibility lie in their hands or in the hands of the artist?
Exactly.
Because they ultimately are the ones that are pushing that on their platforms.
Exactly.
So, then,
yeah. so it's a tricky debate.
Question, Maverick. Mm. So you get a young artist in the studio with you and he comes on a track, his verse is like 2-0, 3-0, man down on Op Block yesterday, yeah, last night. No, I'm just...
No,
just
no.
No, this is what the tune's about.
Yeah, yeah, 100.
3-0,
yeah,
on the Op Block, yeah, 4-door, you know what I'm saying? Skirt, yeah, skirt, skirt. Nah, I'm just and he comes, yeah, in, and he, yeah, he comes, and that's his verse on your track, yeah, innit? And yeah, you, obviously, he's expressing his opinion.
Mm-hmm.
You knowing the context and the implications of what he's saying, mm-hmm, what's your position there now? I mean, like,
I think for me, if it's down to my own tune, then it's about, you know, what I represent in my own tune and what I want to be represented with as well. So that would be a separate discussion. If it's what he wants to say in his own tunes, that's down to him.
So but you would tell him to take that off your track?
Yeah, 100.
Fair enough. Because you feel 100. Because you feel like it doesn't reflect you, or you feel like it's damaging to other people?
I think, well, both for me. Both. Because a part of what I, for me, what I put out through my music, it was I always tried to stay true to a message that's in my heart of music that's inspired me. And I want to put that out through my music. So for me, that's never been a message that I felt I wanted to you know, promote in my music. So I wouldn't want anyone to come in and, you know, express that, through my art form, if that makes sense, through my expression in that sense. You know what I mean?
So what's your most controversial or problematic track you felt like when dealing with your audience? What is the track that you've released that's got the most backlash? And have you ever had that thought that, you know what, maybe I should have approached it better? Because even as a poet writer, I've said certain things in the past and I'll be like, you know what, I should have worded that better. It was my fault. Have you ever had that moment in your...
There was a song when I was about 18 called Sometimes, and at the end of the song, end of the second verse, there was, I hate the history, I hate the Union Jack, I'll never speak for any man or any flag. That was the last lyric, right? And that was a lyric that got brought up on one side.
That show was on that Channel U and everything.
Yeah,
right?
it was on everything. Yeah. So not that I would ever change it. I never wanted to change it. When I go back on it, I don't regret it. I love it because that's what I wanted to say at that time. But that was the one that gets brought up the most because it's divided people's opinions.
Yeah.
So I'd be at shows, and even depending on where I'd be, if I'm back in Ireland, that lyric goes off. You understand what I mean? Sorry, bang on
table. Because it's really...
that was the one that divided people's opinions. But I quite liked it because it meant people... I had people from, you know, ex-British Army officers that would come to gigs and come up to me and be like, you know, I find that really offensive, that lyric.
And would
like,
you apologise?
No way. I would never apologise. I'd sit down and I'd say, do you know what, you're taking it in one way. Let me explain what I mean by that, because you're taking it as I'm attacking you as a person.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not. I'm attacking what the flag represents.
Oh.
From my knowledge of what the flag has always represented through history. So that's where my opinion's coming from. And even to bring up that discussion, I quite liked it because I always felt that we attach ourselves to too many things and we take things like they're a personal attack on us, specifically flags. You know, representation of what the Union Jack has been over the years isn't an attack necessarily on the everyday working man and woman of this country. It's an attack on the policies and the government and, you know, colonialism and the institutions in this country that have done that for years. So it's like to bring that discussion up, for me, was the whole point of it. Yeah. Some people would take it as like, up the ran, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Down with the Brits and all that. And like, that's another discussion. Like, no, let's delve into that. Don't have that down with the Brits discussion, because it's not everyone. You know, you can't on one side fight for your people as a struggle, but then forget someone else's struggle and it's the same thing. So that for me was the one that stood out the most. And I think that when that came up, I think they took that line out on radio as well.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
Crazy. It's a lot.
Talk about censorship.
I think. Wait, do you know, I feel like I have one last question, And it's, is there a piece of art that has made you feel vulnerable?
Wow.
Because we were talking about, you know, how art has influenced our decisions and how it, you know, changes conversations. But what about, like, how a piece of art has made you feel gentle or soft or just, do you know what I mean? Just not amped, the opposite of amped, just feeling like, oh, wow.
It's a deep one.
Really randomly, just because it's the first thing that came into my head, there was a Biggie lyric on Ready to Die. I can't remember what tune it was on, but he says, my mother's got cancer in her breast. No wonder I'm motherfucking stressed. Yeah?
Things done change.
And my mother at that time, when I really got into that record, was going through a similar experience. So for me, it was like through all the bravado, that little one lyric.
Yeah.
Put me in a place where I was like, all right, he didn't delve too much into it, but it gave me a feeling of like, wait, this is someone from
you're
not even alive anymore, but your message is carried through to a small fella in a little town in New Ross in County Wexford, and because I'm going through something similar, that one lyric was all I needed to hear.
Yeah.
What about you, Femi?
I can't even think.
In cinema, film, art?
I mean, I like slow jams. Like, you know.
Yeah, we love a slow jam.
You know, like, of course, man.
You know what? You know what? Let's be real. You know, like.
What, like Keith Sweat, yeah?
No, not like Keith Sweat.
Genuine.
You know, I'm feeling Daniel Caesar right
now. Oh,
yeah.
Oh,
yeah. That makes me feel soft. That makes me feel. Like, but, like, you know, I'm making it into jokes, but genuinely, like, on a genuine level, like, you know, I suppose, like, you know, there's that album. There's days where I don't feel amped. So we were in Jamaica, we were doing a premiere, there were so many things going on. And like, but whenever I got back to my hotel room, I just wanted to listen to Daniel Caesar.
I hear you.
Just
man.
Because, like, you know, I just needed a different energy within that space. And also, like, you know, some of the lyrics on his latest records, like, it's mad. Like, you know, it's like, how did you even think of
very
that?
Very emotionally advanced.
Yeah, you know, how did you even think of, like, you know, to express love and stuff like that in that way, and relationship and like breakup and like just the full emotional spectrum that you go through in love. And so I really dig that. I dig that record. That's my record, one of my records at the moment.
Yeah, okay.
And so because of that, I would say that, but I can't think of anything else. Like film wise, as a film made me cry. Do you know what film made me cry years ago? Oh my gosh, it's just come to me. Do you know Crash?
Yeah.
Is that the LA film?
Banging film, like, there's four different stories, five different stories.
Yeah. And Ludacris is in it.
So
there's a scene, yeah? Oh, my gosh. I think I cried. I was by myself. I swear. I didn't even have children at this point. There's a scene where the Mexican or Puerto Rican guy, he gives his daughter a chain or something, and there's an Iranian guy that goes to his house. He's angry with him because his jewelry shop gets robbed, and he thinks it's because the Puerto Rican guy or the Mexican guy, I can't remember where he's from, basically didn't fix his lock properly and set him up to get robbed. And he takes his gun and he goes to shoot the guy's daughter, and, like, you think his daughter's been shot, but she's not been shot. And the daughter thinks it's because her dad gave her the chain.
Okay, I remember what you're talking about.
I think that was, like, one of the first few scenes in anything, like, that's the only scene in a film as an adult that has made me cry.
You look like you're tearing up now. Yeah, I feel like.
But
really
the thing is, no, it properly like, I was so into that film, like, because everyone had been talking Crash, and I was like, oh yeah, let me just put the. There was a Saturday, like, I used to live by myself at the time and I was bored, so I thought, you know what, let me watch this Crash thing, put on the DVD, and I'm watching it. But I was so in. And, like, that was one of the stories that I was able to identify with, because here was this guy that was working hard, like, you know, he's got, like, you know, he's raising his daughter and he's got all of this stuff, and, like, you know, someone almost takes her life. And I was just, I had a tear in my eye, man.
Oh, it's been such a wonderful conversation. Thank you both so much.
Thank you guys.
For having us.
I really, really
you.
Appreciate the fact that we've gone from discussing drill to, like, talking about crying and gentleness. And I think it's just really, it's really important that you get to express that layer of yourself, because both of you are really, really incredible creators. And as much as there is vulnerability in your work, it's really, really wonderful to be able to see you express your own kind of vulnerability. And this podcast is all about learning from each other and making sure that we're all on the same ground, like, no one is smarter than anybody in this room. And so I want to wrap up by asking everyone to say what they've learned today. So I'll start with you. Have you learned anything today?
Why are you doing this? Why?
All right, do you know what? I'll give you time.
I have learned. Let me think. No, I'm a slow thinker, but I'm a very precise thinker.
Do you want me to ask Maverick why you're calculating? Yeah. Okay, Maverick.
I don't know. Yeah, it's been a wicked discussion. I think, like, learning, it's kind of learning on a point that I already, like, think a lot about, and it's about, like, the last question more so than anything, and about being vulnerable. And I think even discussing topics like this, everyone's got, you know, various range of opinions on it, but we all have to be vulnerable to give them opinions in the first place. Mm-hmm. So I think that's something that's needed right now more than ever. So it's just nice to be in a room with people who are vulnerable enough to speak their mind. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I've learnt from Femi that it, like, if your gut is telling you that something doesn't feel right, listen to it. Because, like you were saying, and there was a scene that you felt like you had to remove, because, like, if you couldn't watch it, then how would you be able to expect other people to take it? And I think that's a really, really important responsibility that you placed on yourself, and you did the right thing in that situation, because something was telling you this isn't right and you followed that. And that's definitely taught me that if I have a gut feeling that's telling me that this doesn't feel right, I am in control and I'm in charge of my art and I decide. And it's really important that I honour that feeling. So thank you for sharing that, because I've learnt that.
Thank you.
What about you, Silly?
I think it kind of expanded on an understanding of concepts in terms of something, a mixture between something of what Maverick said and kind of what Femi said as well. So when we were talking about the concept of violence, and I suddenly realised that we categorise terms based on our limited understanding of it. Like, if we hear violence, we conceptualise it depending on where it's coming from. Mm-hmm. So when he's addressed, like, intent, it kind of spurred what Maverick was talking about, how people in Ireland only saw rap as, it's going to talk about guns, you're going to talk about girls. Then when Femi then sprung off that talk about the intent, and he talked about how it's an action movie, I realised in my head, I've never once thought of it like that. I just thought, right, it's a road movie, it's a Mandem movie. Do you know what I'm saying?
It's a Mandem movie.
But then when you break... No, because there's one scene where it gets... comes out and he just sprays the Uzi, you know what I mean? And I was like, right, is he Rambo? But it's an action movie, so why can't he do that? You know what I'm saying? It's not, you know what I'm saying? So I really understand how we stigmatise things based on, like, our perceptions of it, or where we think they're coming from, what communities bring delivering it to us. But at the same time, you have to diversify your thinking in these areas.
Word. Femi, have you been able to think?
So obviously it's back to me. I think the main thing that I've taken, my main takeaway, is who decides, who has power to censor stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like maybe I don't have the answer for that yet from this discussion. Maybe I don't. I think that is the discussion, mm-hmm. actually. That the true discussion is who decides what is violent. Like, who decides what is too violent?
Yeah.
Like, do you get what I'm saying? Are we to leave that to the artist to have the responsibility? Like, in the case of the drill artist, to decide what they say?
Mm.
Are we to... When does freedom of speech go too far? And who decides when freedom of speech has gone too far?
Right.
And, you know, you talk about... like, when you're talking about NWA and you're talking about, you know, that song and the fact that actually that was too violent for the time, but, like, actually there was violence of the state going on against these guys and people within their community at the time.
So it's one perception of it being an incitement of violence, but it's another perception of it being like a response.
No, this is a response, you know, a to the violence against my person. Like, you know, and that's, for me, I feel like, I think violence of the state, who manages that? Do you go, because the state can be violent, right?
That's true.
The state can be violent.
Inherently it is.
Yeah, and the state is violent. So who then censors them?
Like, how can a system that is built on violence then try to police people that are responding to the violence with violence? Right.
I think that's
and then,
exactly
and then blame
it.
And then blame young kids for, oh, well, you're, like, yeah, you're inciting the violence. But what about the violence these young kids are seeing that you act out every night on the news?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Your reaction as a country.
I mean, like, even, like, you know, like, if we think about violence in a broader term, like, you know, child poverty is violence against...
Poverty in itself is,
like,
violence.
Like, you know, that's violence, you know. Like, you know, like, when you really think... I went to school, I was saying this the other day, I went to school with boys that would go around the playground asking for money to buy lunch.
That's real.
That, for me, and I only thought about this the other day, actually, that's when they talk about child poverty and like children. But I never thought any of the people that I knew growing up were
that's
poor.
Real talk, yeah. You know,
but they were poor because like they, like you know, they didn't have money for lunch. If your parents can't give you lunch money, you're poor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm not slighting the parents. I'm saying
no,
until
it's a reality,
we're able to eradicate that, that's a violent of the violence of the state. Mm. And like, I'm not even gonna get onto the police because we'll be here all night. But like, you know, there's subtle things like that that you know. For me, like, who manages that? Who brings the state to question for the violence that they effect on the citizens?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, man, you've left us with something to think about, boy. This could go on forever.
Boy.
Thank you so much, man.
Thank you, guys, man.
Thank
really,
you,
really appreciate it, man. Thank you guys very much.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley. For the love of home.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.